You're listening to a podcast hosted by Med Learning Group.
Hello, and welcome to this podcast, Updates in the Management of Agitation Associated with Dementia Due to Alzheimer's Disease. In this episode, we discuss best practices for screening and diagnosing patients with AD-related agitation. My name is Deb Gordon, and I'm thrilled to host today's podcast. I'm joined by Dr. Brad Dickerson, who directs the Frontotemporal Disorders Unit at Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston. Welcome, Dr. Dickerson.
Hi, Deb. It's nice to be here, and it's nice to be here with our audience today as well.
Let's just start with the basics, which is let's start with the definition of agitation in Alzheimer's disease. It's something you don't see talked about a lot in the mainstream.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that when you read about Alzheimer's disease, you read about biomarkers and cognitive impairment and amyloid and all kinds of things. But in clinical practice, we know that agitation is a really important, challenging symptom to deal with. It's present in up to 80% of patients with Alzheimer's disease at some point in the course of the illness, often in the moderate to severe dementia stage, but sometimes in the milder stage. And agitation is defined as excessive motor or verbal activity without any particular focus or intent. In granular terms, it tends to be physical or verbal, and it can be non-aggressive, such as when a person is wandering or hoarding things or pacing. That's physical agitation that is not particularly aggressive if someone won't sit still, for example, and is just moving a lot. Whereas the physical agitation may be aggressive when there's pushing or hitting or throwing or other what might be considered violent behavior toward another person or toward an object. And then there's verbal agitation, which may be non-aggressive if a person is complaining or repeating or talking to someone who's not there or obsessing over things. Or it can be verbal behavior that's aggressive if there's anger and shouting and swearing or screaming even. So I think there are different flavors of agitation, but it's essentially a heightened state of activity that is often associated with a negative mood state, even if it's just momentary. Sometimes it's very brief and fleeting. Other times it's longer lasting.
How do caregivers describe it? When do you clinicians know to start looking for agitation and trying to diagnose it?
So sometimes it comes up during a routine checkup where you're asking the patient and family member what's been going on since the last time we saw each other, and they may be talking about a variety of issues. And at some point they might say, well, occasionally, for example, the spouse might say, well, occasionally when I'm trying to direct my spouse to do something, such as get ready in the morning if there's an appointment, he might get upset, and sometimes he might yell at me or might push me if I'm trying to help him get dressed. And so it may come up as a matter of course in a checkup, but not be a specific problem, or it may be the kind of thing that gets flagged right at the beginning of the checkup as a big problem that's been occurring since the last time we saw each other. Or it may be an urgent care call where the caregiver typically calls the office or seeks an urgent care visit to discuss a problem that has emerged sometimes very recently and sometimes in a very intense way. So it can come to light in a variety of ways. Sometimes it needs to be screened for. Usually when that's the case, it's not as prominent of a problem. Other times the caregiver brings it to the clinician's attention as a serious problem that needs to be addressed.
Well, you gave me the segue into the next question, which is about screening. When, how, why?
Yeah, so I think we usually think about listening to the care partner, caregiver, as part of a regular check. Also, probing for pertinent positives or pertinent negatives that the caregiver might not have thought of volunteering in their interval history since the last time we saw the patient and the caregiver. And so if they have not brought it to our attention, it's always good to screen for agitation because it may be less frequent, or in some cases the care partner or patient may not realize that it's part of the illness. And so common, you can simply ask about it in your interview, or there are scales with probably the most widely used scale being the neuropsychiatric inventory. And so in our practice, we like to give the care partner, typically the neuropsychiatric inventory, as a questionnaire prior to the visit, along with some other questionnaires about symptoms, and ask them to fill it out. And that covers a variety of different types of neuropsychiatric symptoms, including agitation, and asks whether it's present, and asks if it's present, how severe it is and how distressing it is. And that way, you've got a pretty efficient way to run down that list of pertinent negatives if the caregiver endorses the item as not present, or if they endorse it as present, then it serves as a springboard for your structured interview to try to figure out what exactly is going on that led them to endorse that question as being present. There are also more specific scales that probe in more depth agitation itself, such as the Brief Agitation Rating Scale, the Cohen-Mansfield Agitation Inventory, the Pittsburgh Agitation Scale, and others that are often used in clinical trials, but sometimes can be used in nursing homes or can be used in office-based clinical practice in the community. I don't tend to see those being used as often. I think a lot of times people will use these, clinicians will use these kinds of screening instruments and then probe with a structured interview. But sometimes it can be helpful to measure it with an instrument like that, especially if you're trying to evaluate whether an intervention is helpful and you want to judge whether the symptom is diminishing over time.
What about a differential diagnosis? What else should clinicians look for beyond the neuropsychiatric potential cause?
So I think that the first question in all of our minds should really be, is there some kind of a medical condition that could be contributing to this? And first and foremost, is there actually delirium present? So in some cases, for example, a person may become acutely agitated because they've become delirious as a result of a urinary tract infection or a pneumonia or some other medical illness that has occurred recently. And rather than the usual symptom that a person may experience, whether it's pain or shortness of breath or other symptoms, they might simply get upset and agitated and really act from a behavioral perspective, not like themselves. If that comes on acutely over the course of a day or two or within the course of a week, it's always important to start with an urgent care visit to evaluate for a medical condition that may be contributing to or causing agitation as part of an overall encephalopathic or delirious state. That may be in the neurologic category, such as pain, or potentially infections. In the more general medical category, such as electrolyte abnormalities, thyroid abnormalities, hyper or hypoglycemia, may be toxic related to medications, medication side effects, over-the-counter supplements, alcohol use or other substance use, or other kinds of medical conditions that are sometimes common and often not that serious, but can be conditions that provoke agitation, such as constipation or urinary retention. And so we need to consider all of those issues when we think about agitation. If we can rule out either by history and physical or potentially also with laboratory tests or a more in-depth medical assessment, medical contributors to these kinds of symptoms, then we're left with the question of, is this just a symptom of the disease itself? And if so, we need to try to figure out what's the pattern that brings it on, what are the provoking and palliating factors, and what's the temporal course, and is there a particular time of day when it occurs, and the usual kinds of questions that you ask when you're trying to understand the nature of a symptom in a patient with an illness.
Why is it so important to make a definitive diagnosis?
Well, I think it's important to identify the specific nature of a person's behavioral or psychological symptoms when they have dementia, because a lot of times family members have interpretations about what those symptoms are. They might say, my husband is very anxious. And it turns out that there's a heightened sense of arousal and the person is pacing maybe later in the afternoon as a result of sundowning, which could be anxiety or it could be psychosis in some cases, or it could be agitation that is not clearly associated with anxiety. And so I think it's important to listen to the words that the care partner uses, but then also to try to deconstruct that description and really get at the nature of it, because that really can determine when the clinician ultimately makes their own assessment and decides, is this agitation that is likely due to Alzheimer's disease itself as opposed to a different underlying medical condition or other condition? That really influences the nature of the treatment and I think is really fundamental to understanding what the symptom is that the person is describing.
Yeah, one question I wanted to ask was, how do you differentiate between agitation and psychosis?
That can be very difficult. I think usually with psychosis, people are talking about their perceptions or their beliefs in a way that makes it clear that they're either believing something that's not true, a delusion, for example, that someone is trying to harm them in some way or someone is stealing from them. It's always important to make sure that that's not actually true. Sometimes it is actually true. Most of the time, it's a delusion that may be paranoid and is common in patients with Alzheimer's disease, especially in the moderate stage of dementia. And then I think trying to figure out if a person is having hallucinations is important. Sometimes that's just observing them and watching how they're acting, if they look like they're looking at something or look like they're talking to someone. Sometimes they can describe it to you. They can say, I'm seeing some people over in the corner over there and they shouldn't be in the house. Or sometimes they'll actually tell you, there's a little boy following me around and he won't leave me alone. So it can be completely clear and overt based on what the patient is saying, or it can take a little bit of a detective investigation to try to figure out if there's a psychotic element happening. Sometimes people are just upset and there's no clear evidence that they're seeing things or hearing things that aren't there, hallucinating or having delusions with false beliefs. And that's also very common. And it's especially common around personal care activities, simple interactions that can provoke a person when they may not understand what their care partner is trying to get them to do. But it's pretty clear that it's tied to the personal care activities and not related to some kind of psychosis that's occurring in between those activities.
Any advice for, a lot of patients with Alzheimer's mainly see a primary care doctor. Any advice for the primary care physician in terms of diagnosing this during, what is often a fairly rushed visit?
That's a challenge. And I think some primary care doctors are very proficient in evaluating the behavioral and psychological symptoms of Alzheimer's disease or other dementias. Other primary care doctors or other clinicians really don't feel comfortable doing that and often have referral pathways, whether it's a psychiatric nurse practitioner or a geriatric psychiatrist. And more we see people making use of electronic consult options so that people don't actually always have to wait for a in-person office visit. Sometimes telehealth options are available as well. For any clinician that has a practice that includes patients with Alzheimer's disease, and when they follow them, especially into the moderate stage of dementia and beyond, it's important for them to either figure out whether they're going to try to become proficient themselves at diagnosing and managing agitation and other common behavioral and psychological symptoms of dementia, or whether they want to have a fairly superficial approach to it with a set of referral options that allow them to get the patient the right kind of expertise that's needed to address the problem.
Great. So before we wrap up, what have I not asked you about? What other messages would you like to get across to our listening audience?
Well, I think the education is really a critical factor here. And so at some point, we will often see either irritability beginning to emerge or something that suggests that agitation may be coming. And whether it's then or possibly even before then, I think exposing patients when it makes sense, but especially care partners to educational options and guiding them toward educational materials that help them understand the nature of these kinds of symptoms and the fact that they're common and they're a result of the brain disease, but often are very influenced by the environment and the way that the care partner is interacting with the patient, I think can help empower care partners to feel better equipped to understand the nature of the symptoms and how they may be able to influence them and hopefully prevent some of the problems from occurring or help de-escalate them when they do occur.
Excellent. Thank you so much. In other parts of this series, we'll be talking more about treatment as well. But of course, you have to have the diagnosis first. That's all the time we have. I want to thank you so much, Dr. Dickerson, for this enlightening discussion. And I want to thank our listeners for joining us. And we hope you'll listen to another episode from this series. This podcast was brought to you by MedLearning Group. MedLearning Group is accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education to provide continuing medical education for physicians. This CME activity was planned and produced in accordance with the ACCME Essentials. And I want to give a special thank you to our supporters, Otsuka America Pharmaceutical Inc. and Lundbeck, who provided an educational grant for this activity.